a vast, majestic motion, whose size concealed its terrifying, dream-like speed. Now the crests and troughs were enormously greater. Now they were very much farther apart. And now the crests were curling over and breaking as they came, an avalanche of white pouring down the steep face. The Surprise was running almost straight before them, east by south. She'd managed to strike her mizzen-topmast at first light, anything to diminish the wind pressure aft and thus the risk of broaching to, and man-ropes were rigged along her streaming deck. As his eyes reached the level of the quarter-deck, he saw a wave, a grey-green wall towering above the taffrail, racing towards them. Swift inevitability. He strained his head back to see its top, curving beyond the vertical as it came, yet still balancing with the speed of its approach, a beard of wind-torn spray flying out before it. He heard Jack call an order to the man at the wheel. The frigate moved a trifle from her course, rose, tilting her stern skywards, so that Stephen clung backwards to the ladder, rose and rose, and the mortal wave swept under her counter, dividing and passing on to smother her waist in foam and solid water, on to bar the horizon just ahead, while the ship sank in the trough, and the shriek of the rigging sank an octave as the strain slackened. "Seize hold, Doctor!" shouted Jack. "Take both hands to it!" Stephen crept along the lifeline, catching a reproachful look from the four men at the wheel, as who should say, "Look what you've done with your albatrosses, mate," and reached the stanchion to which Jack was lashed. "Good morning, sir," he said. "A very good morning to you. It's coming on to blow."
"What?"
"It's coming on to blow," said Jack with greater force. Stephen frowned and looked astern through the haze of spray, and there, whiter than the foam, were two albatrosses racing across the wind. One wheeled towards the ship, rose to the height of the taffrail, and poised there in the eddy not 10 feet away. He saw its mild, round eye looking back at him. The perpetual, minute change of its wing feathers, its tail. Then it banked, rose on the wind, darted down, and its wings raised high, it paddled on the face of an advancing cliff of water, picked something up, and shot away along the valley of the wave before it broke. Killick appeared, with a sour, mean look on his face, all screwed up against the wind. He passed the coffee-pot from the bosom of his jacket. Jack put the spout into his mouth and drank. "You'd better go below," he shouted to Stephen. "Go below and have some breakfast. You may not get another hot meal if it turns nasty." The gunroom was of the same opinion. They had their table spread with boiled ham, beefsteaks, and a sea pie, all held down as tight as double-row fiddles would hold them, but all mingling their gravy in reckless confusion. "Sea pie, Doctor?" said Etheridge, beaming at him. "I've kept your piece."
"If you please."
Stephen held out his plate, received the piece on the top of the rise, and as the frigate shot down the face of the wave, so the pie rose in the air. Etheridge instantly pinned it with his practiced fork, held it until she reached the trough, and gravity went to work again. Pullings gave him a selected biscuit and told him with a smile that the glass was falling, yet it had to be worse before it got better, and begged him to blow out his luff while he might. The purser was telling them of an infallible method of calculating the height of waves by simple triangulation when Harvey, plunged into the gunroom, spouting water like an inverted fountain. "Oh, dear, dear," he said, throwing his tarpaulins into his cabin and putting on his spectacles. "Give me a cup of tea, Babington, there's a good fellow. My fingers are too numb to turn the tap." "The tea's gone by the board, sir. Would coffee do?" "Anything, anything, so long as it's warm and wet. Is there any sea pie left?" They showed him the empty dish. "Why, here's a pretty thing," he cried. "All night on deck and no sea pie." When Ham had mollified him, Stephen said, "Why did you spend all night on deck, pray?" "The skipper wouldn't go below, though I begged him to turn in, and I couldn't very well do so with him on deck. I have a noble nature," said Harvey, smiling now through the ham. "Are we in extreme peril, then?" asked Stephen. "Oh, yes," they assured him with grave, anxious faces. "They were in horrid danger of foundering, broaching to, running violently into Australia. But there was a hope, just a very slight hope, of their meeting with a mountain of ice and clambering on to it. As many as half a dozen men might be saved." When they'd exercised their wit for some considerable time, Harvey said, "The skipper's worried about the foretopmast. We went aloft to look at it, and, would you credit it, the force of the wind upon us as we went aloft threw the shift a point off her course. The coking just above the cap is not what any of our friends could wish, and if a cross sea sets in and we start to roll, I shall start saying my prayers." "Mr. Stanhope begs Dr. Maturin to spare him a minute when convenient," said Killick in his ear. He found them sitting in the cold, dark cabin by the light of a purser's dip. Mr. White, Atkins, a young attaché called Barclay, on chairs with their feet in the water that swilled fore and aft with a dismal sound, all wearing greatcoats with the collars turned up. Mr. Stanhope, half lying on the couch, servants lurking in the shadows. Apparently they'd not been fed, and their spirit stoves wouldn't work. They were all quite silent. Mr. Stanhope was extremely obliged to Dr. Maturin for coming so quick. He didn't wish to give the least trouble, but should be grateful if he might be told whether this was the end. Water was coming in through the sides, and a seaman had given his valet to understand that this was the gravest sign of all. One of the young gentlemen had confirmed this to Mr. Atkins, adding that being pooped was more likely than actual foundering or breaking in two, though neither possibility was to be overlooked. What did being pooped imply? Could they be of any use? Stephen said that as far as his understanding went, the real danger lay in a following wave striking the back of the ship such a buffet as to twirl it sideways to the wind, when it would lie down, receive the next wave broadside on, and so be overwhelmed. Hence the necessity for speed, for flying before the wind with all sail that could be set, and for steering with due attention to outrun and to avoid these blows. Yet they were to consider that as the ship was exposed to the full force of the blast when it was on the top of the monstrous wave, so it was sheltered in the hollow some 50 feet below, where nevertheless the forward speed must be maintained to enable the ship to be guided in the desired direction and to diminish the relative velocity of the ensuing wave, and that this necessarily called for a nice adjustment of the various sails and ropes in all their complexity. But as far as he could tell, all these things were being done with conscientious diligence, and for his part, under such a commander, with such a crew and such a vessel, he felt no rational apprehension whatsoever. "Captain Aubrey has repeatedly stated in my hearing that the Surprise is the very finest frigate of her tonnage in the Royal Navy. The water coming in was inconvenient and even disconcerting, but it was a usual phenomenon in such circumstances, particularly in aged vessels. It was what the mariners termed the working of the ship. And he cautioned them against too literal a belief in the words of the sailors. "They take an obscure delight in practising upon us landlubbers." Once he was relieved of the sensation of imminent death, Mr. Stanhope relapsed into the appalling dry seasickness that had struck him in the night. As Stephen and the chaplain helped him into his cot, he said, with an attempt at a smile, "So grateful. Not quite suited for sea travel. Never undertake sea voyage again. If there's no way home by land, shall stay in Kampong forever." But the others grew indignant, shrill and vocal. Mr. White thought it scandalous that government should have sent them in so small a boat, and one that leaked. Did Dr. Maturin realize that it was very cold at sea? Far colder than on land. Mr. Atkins said that the officers he had questioned replied in an off-hand manner or not at all, and that surely the captain should have waited upon His Excellency with an explanation before this. Last night's supper had been disgracefully underdone. He should like to see the captain. "You will find him on the quarter-deck," said Stephen. "I'm sure he will be happy to listen to your complaints." In the silence that followed this, Mr. Barclay said in a lugubrious tone, "And all our chamber pots are broken." Stephen made his way forward to the sick bay through the soaking, smelly berth deck, where the watch below was sleeping, fully clothed, sleeping in spite of the tremendous pitch and the roar, for all hands had been called three times that night. He found the usual accidents, the bangs and bruises of a furious storm. One man had been flung against the fluke of an anchor, another had pitched headfirst down the forehatch as it was being battened down, another had contrived to impale himself on his own marline spike, but nothing that went beyond the surgeon's powers. What worried them was their worst pneumonia, an elderly seaman named Woods. It had been touch and go with him before the storm. And now the prodigious shaking, the absence of rest, had turned the scale. Stephen listened to his breathing, felt his pulse, exchanged a few low words with M'Allister, and finished his round in silence. On deck he found the scene changed once more. The wind had increased, and it had backed 3 points. The nature of the sea had changed. Now, instead of the regular procession of vast rollers, there was a confusion of waves running across, bursting seas that filled the valleys with leaping spray. The underlying pattern was still the same, but now the crests were a quarter of a mile apart and even higher than before, though at times this was less evident because of the turmoil between. There were no albatrosses anywhere in sight. Yet still the frigate ran on at this racing speed, under the precious scrap of canvas followed, rising nobly to the gigantic waves, shouldering the cross-seas aside. The launch had been carried away in spite of the boatswain's treble gripes, but there seemed to be no other damage. She was beginning to roll now as well as pitch, and on each plunge her head and the lee side of her forecastle vanished under white water. All the officers were on deck, wedged into odd corners. Mr. Bowes, unrecognizable in tarpaulins, caught Stephen as a weather lurch knocked him off his balance, and guided him along the lifeline to the captain, still standing there by his stanchion. He waited while Jack told Callow to go below and read the barometer, and then said, "Woods of the afterguard is sinking fast. If you wish to see him before he dies, you must come soon." Jack reflected, automatically calling out his orders to the men at the wheel. Dared he leave the deck at this stage? Callow came crawling aft. "Rising, sir," he shouted. "It's risen 2 lines and a half, and Mr. Harvey desires me to say the relieving tackles are hooked on." Jack nodded. "That means a stronger blow," he said. Glancing at the foretopsail mole-eaten in the tropics. But they'd done all they could to strengthen it, and so far the storm canvas held. "I'll come now while I can." He cast himself off, called the master and Pullings to take his place, and blundered heavily below. In the cabin he drank off a glass of wine and flexed his arms. "I'm sorry to hear what you tell me about poor old Woods," he said, still in the same hoarse roar. Then, moderating his voice, "Is there no hope?" Stephen shook his head. "I say, Stephen, I hope Mr. Stanhope and his people are not too tumbled about, not too upset." "No, I told them the Surprise was a capital ship and that all was well." "So it is too. As long as the foretopsail holds, she's the bravest ship that ever swam. And if the glass is right, this'll blow out in a couple of days. Come, let's go along." "Don't be too distressed. It is horrible to see and hear, but he feels nothing. It is a very easy death." Horrible it was. Woods was a leaden blue, and the animal sound of his laboured breath sounded louder close to than the all-pervading din. He might have recognised Jack, he might not. His open mouth and half-closed eyes showed little change. Jack did his duty, said the words expected of a captain. It touched him to the quick. Spent a few moments with the other men, and hurried back to his stanchion. A quarter of an hour yet, what a change! When he went below, the frigate had no more than a 10-degree roll. Now her larboard cathead touched green water. And still they came sweeping up from the black westwards, the gigantic streaming seas taller than ever, impossibly tall, and their foam filled her waist 5 feet deep, while the whole of her forecastle vanished as she plunged. Still she rose, pouring water, spouting from her scuppers. Every time she rose. More heavily now. In the cabin, one of Mr. Stanhope's servants, half drunk, had managed to blow himself up with a spirit stove. Miserably burnt and shattered by falling against a gun, he was being patched up by the surgeons. Mr. White, Mr. Atkins, and Mr. Barclay, all of whom had struggled earnestly in London to reach this position, sat wedged together on the couch, with their feet tucked up out of the water, staring in front of them. Hour after hour. On deck, the day was fading, if that grey, shrieking murk could be called day. Yet still Jack could see the rollers sweeping towards her stern from half a mile away, their white tops clear. Their whole length traversed the sky as the frigate rolled, and 2 monstrous waves, too close to one another, exploded in ruin just astern, to be swept up into a still greater hole that thundered as it came, vast and overwhelming. And above the thunder, as it passed, his waiting ear caught a sharp, gun-like crack. A crash followed, and the foremast went by the board. The foretopsail ripped from its yard, vanished far ahead, a flickering whiteness in the gloom. "All hands! All hands!" he roared. Already the ship was steering wild, yawing off her course. He glanced back. They were running down into the trough. Unless they could get her before the wind, could get some headsail on her, the next wave would poop her. She would broach to and take the next sea on her beam. "All hands!" His voice tearing blood from his throat. "Pullings! Men into the force rounds! It's gone above the cap! Four staysails! Four staysails! Come along with me! Axes! Axes! In the momentary lull of the deepest trough, he raced along the gangway, followed by 20 men. A cross sea broke over the side, waist-deep. They ploughed through, and they were on the forecastle before the ship, slewed half across the wind, began to rise. Before the next wave was more than halfway to them. Men were swarming up the weather ratlins, forcing themselves up against the strength of the gale. Their backs made sail enough to bring a head a little round before the sea struck them with an all-engulfing crash and spout of foam. Far enough around for the wave to take her abaft the beam, and still she swam. The axes cleared the wreckage. Bondon was out on the bowsprit, hacking at the foretopmast stay that still held fast to the floating mast, slewing the ship around. Holding his breath, Jack swarmed out after him, his head under the foam, feeling for the gaskets of the forestaysail, snugged down tight under the stay. He had it. His hands, many hands, were tearing at the lashings, so tight they would not come. "Hold on!" roared in his ear. And there was a strong hand pressing on his neck, then an unimaginable force of water, a weight and a strength past anything. The third wave that broached the frigate squarely to. The pressure slackened. His head was above water, and now there were more men in the shrouds. Again the thrust of the gale on them brought her head round, helped by a savage cross-sea. But they couldn't hold there for ever. A few more minutes of this and the shrouds would be swept clear. Down again as she plunged. And running his hand along the sail, he found the trouble. The downhauler had fouled the clue. Stray lines from the wreckage in the hanks. Knife! He roared as his head came clear. It was in his reaching hand, a lightning slash, and all sprang free. Hold on! Hold on! And again the thunder of a falling sea, a mountainous wave, the intolerable pressure on his chest, the total certainty that he must not let go of the sail clutched under him. His legs curled round the bowsprit to hold on. Hold on! Strength going! But here was breath again in his bursting lungs, and he reared up out of the water, bawling, "Man the halyards! Do you hear me aft? Man the halyards there!" In slow jerks, the sail rose up the stay, filled. They sheeted home. But now she was broadside on, wallowing. Or would it be in time? Slowly, heavily, she turned as the forestaysail took the strain, the great wave racing up, turned just enough, and took it on her quarter, rose to the height, and the full blast in the headsail set her right before the wind. Faster and faster she moved, steering nimbly now. For though the last blow had flung the men from the wheel, the relieving tackles held, and the next wave passed harmlessly under her stern. He swarmed in, clinging to the knightheads for a moment as she plunged again, and then he was on the forecastle. It was clear of wreckage, the sails set well. He called the men down from the shrouds and moved along the gangway. "Any hands lost, Harvey?" was asked, with his arms round the stanchion. "No, sir. Some hurt, but they've all come aft. Are you all right, sir?" Jack nodded. "She steers better," he said. "Dismiss the watch below. Grog for all hands. Serve it out in the half-deck. Pass the word for the bosun." All night. The officers stayed on deck that endless night, or spent a few brief spells in the gunroom, sitting between, dreaming and waking, listening gravely, concentrated upon that one triangle of rigid canvas forward. After an hour, Jack found the trembling that had affected his entire body die away, and with it, even the consciousness of his body. The wheel was relieved. Relieved again. Again. Continually his croaking voice called out orders, and twice he sent picked parties forward, strengthening, flapping, making all as fast as ever they could in a night that cut to the bone. A little before dawn the wind veered a point, two points, blowing with sudden flaws, vacuums that hurt his ears. It reached a screaming note more savage than anything he'd heard, and his heart hurt him for the staysail, for the ship. An edge of sentiment and self-pity, with Sophia's name hovering on the edge of utterance aloud. Then, slowly, slowly, the shriek dropped half a tone. Another and another. A low, buffeting roar at last, when the faint, straggling light showed a sea white from rim to rim, with the steady procession of great rollers in their due, solemn, ordered ranks once again. Vast indeed, but no longer maniac. No cross sea, very little roll, and the surprise scudding over the desolation, passing every sea under her counter, her waist with no more than a foot of water swirling about it. An albatross broad on the starboard beam. He cast off his lashings and moved stiffly forward. "We'll ship the pumps, Mr. Harvey, if you please. And I believe we may get a scrap of main topsail on her. Peace. Peace." Madagascar lay astern and the Cormorans. The shattered hulk that had crept north of the 40th parallel, trailing ends of rope and pumping day and night, was now as trim as art and a limited supply of paint could make her. An expert eye would have seen a great deal of twice-laid stuff in the rigging, and an odd scarcity of boats on the booms. It would have stared with amazement at the attachments of the rudder, and it would have noted that, in spite of fair and moderate breeze, the frigate carried nothing above her topsails. She dared not. Although with her new foretopmast and her fresh paintwork she looked as pretty as a picture, her inward parts had suffered. Jack spoke so often of her butt-ends and her hanging knees that Stephen said, "Captain Aubrey, your butt-ends and your hanging knees cannot be attempted to be rectified, as I understand you, until you have her docked 3,000 miles away. So may I beg you to clap a stopper over all, and to accept the inevitable with a decent appearance of unconcern? If we fall apart, why, we fall apart, and there is the end to it. For my part, I have every confidence of reaching Bombay." "What I know, and what you don't know," cried Jack, "is that I have not so much as a single 10-inch spike left aboard." "God set a flower upon you, my dear, with your 10-inch spike," said Stephen. "Of course I know it. You've mentioned them daily these last 200 leagues, together with your hanging ends and double-sister blocks, and nightly, too, prattling in your sleep. Bow. Bow to predestination. Or at least confine yourself to silent prayer." "Not so much as a 10-inch spike, nor a mast or boom, but what he's fished," said Jack, shaking his head. And it was true. Yet, with an irritating complacency, Mr. Stanhope, his suite, and now even Dr. Maturin cried out that this was delightful now. That was the only way of travelling. A postchaise on the turnpike road was nothing in comparison of this. They should recommend it to all their friends. Certainly it was delightful for the passengers, the smooth sea, the invigorating breeze carrying them steadily into warmer airs. But in the latitude of the Isle of France, Jack, his carpenter and boatswain, and all his seaman-like officers looked out eagerly for a French privateer. A spare topmast or so, a few spars, 100 fathoms of 1.5-inch rope would have made them so happy. They stared with all their might, and the Indian Ocean remained as empty as the South Atlantic, and here there were not even whales. On and on she sailed, in warmer seas but void, as though they alone had survived Deucalion's flood, as though all land had vanished from the earth. And once again the ship's routine dislocated time and temporal reality, so that this progress was an endless dream, even a circular dream, contained within an unbroken horizon and punctuated only by the sound of guns thundering daily in preparation for an enemy whose real existence it was impossible to conceive. Stephen laid down his pistols, wiped the barrels with his handkerchief, and shut the case. They were warm from his practice, but still the bottle, hanging from the fore-yardarm, swung there intact. It was not the fault of the pistols, either. They were the best Joe Manton could produce, and the purser had hit the mark 3 times. It was true that Stephen had been firing left-handed, the right having suffered worse at Port Mahon. About a year ago he would certainly have knocked the bottle down, left-hand or not. Pressing? Trying too hard? He sighed, and pondering over the nature of muscular and nervous coordination, he groped his way up into the mizzen-top. Mr. Atkins gazed after him, more nearly convinced that it would be safe to quarrel with him once they reached Bombay. Reaching the futtock shrouds, Stephen took a sudden determination. If his body would not obey him in one way, it should in another. He seized the ropes that ran outwards to the rim of the platform, and instead of making his way into the top by writhing through them, he forced his person grunting upwards. A diagonal reversed climb with his back towards the sea, and himself hanging at an angle of 45 degrees. And so reached his goal by the path a seaman would have taken. A sailor, but no landsman bound by the ordinary law of gravity. Vonden was still peering down the lubber's hole, the way Stephen had always come before, the safe, direct, logical but ignominious road. And his unsuccessful attempt at disguising his astonishment when he turned was a consolation to Stephen's mind. Its element of vanity glowed cherry pink. Mastering a laboured gasp that would have ruined the effect, he said, "Let us go straight to verse." This was all that one inspiration could accomplish, and he paused, as if in thought, until his heart was beating normally. "Verse," he said again, "are you ready, Barrett Bonden? Then dash away. Thus to the eastern wealth through storms we go. But now the Cape once doubled, fear no more. A constant trade-wind will securely blow and gently lay us on the spicy shore." "'An elegant sentiment, sir,' said Bondon. "'As good as Dibdin any day. "'If you wanted to crab it, which, far from me be it, "'you might say the gent was a trifle out in his trade wind, "'this likely being the monsoon, as we call it by sea. "'But as for wealth, why, that's poetic license, "'or, as you might say, all my eye. "'Spice, maybe.' I'm not saying anything against spice, nor yet spicy shores, though most of them ship, begging your pardon, in Indian ports. But wealth I make so bold as to laugh. Why, sir, baiting a few privateers out of the Isle of France and Reunion, there's not a prize for us in this whole Indian mortal ocean. Not from here to Java Head, not since Admiral Rainier cleaned up Trincomalee. Unless... Maybe we take on Admiral Lenoir and his 74 that chased us so cruel hard in the poor old Sophie. God love us, sir, he was a merry old gentleman. You remember him, sir? Certainly, Stephen remembered him. And that bitter chase in the Mediterranean, the loss of their ship, their capture. Bondon's face changed from smiling reminiscence to stony reserve. He slid his book into his bosom as Mr. Callow's hideous face appeared above the rail, with the captain's compliments and did Dr. Maturin intend shifting his coat. "'Why in God's name would I shift my coat?' cried Stephen. "'What is more, I have no coat on at all.' "'Perhaps he thought you might like to put one on for Mr. Stanhope's dinner, sir. A genteel way of alluding to it.' "'It's within minutes of three bells, sir. The sand's almost out. "'And he particularly begs you, sir, to come down through the... "'to come down the usual way.' "'Mr. Stanhope's dinner,' said Stephen in an undertone. "'He stood up and stared down at the quarter-deck, where, except for her captain, "'all the frigate's officers were gathered in their full-dress uniforms.' Just so. He had forgotten the invitation. How remote it seemed, that quarter-deck, crowded with blue-coats, red-coats, and half a dozen black, with the busy, check-shirted seamen moving among them. No great distance vertically, 50 feet or so, but still, how remote. He knew all the men there, liked several of them, loved young Babington and Pullings. And yet he had the impression of living in a vacuum. It came to him strongly now, though some of the upturned faces were winking and nodding at him. He slid his legs through the lubber's hole with a grave expression on his face and began his laborious descent. So full a ship. So close-packed a world, moving urgently along, surrounded by its own vacuum. Each man bombinating in his own, no doubt. My journal, reread but yesterday, gives me this same impression. An egocentric man living amidst pale shades. It reflects none of the complex, vivid life of this crowded vessel. In its pages, my host, whom I esteem, and his people hardly exist, nor yet the gunroom. He reflected, during intervals of conversation as he sat at the envoy's left, stuffed rapidly into his best coat by Jack's powerful hand, breeched and brushed in 1 minute 20 seconds flat, while the marine sentry, under penalty of death, held the half-hour glass concealed in his hand to prevent the striking of the bell. As he sat there, eating up the last, long-preserved delicacies from Mr. Stanhope's store, and drinking milk-warm claret in honour of the Duke of Cumberland's birthday. But he was not without a social conscience, and aware that he had caused great uneasiness, That his very, very dirty face and hands reflected discredit upon the ship, he exerted himself to talk, to be agreeable. And even after the port had gone round and round, to sing. Mr. Bowes, the purser, had obliged the company with an endless ballad on the 1st of June, in which he had served a gun. It was set to the tune of I Was, Do You See a Waterman, but he produced its slow length in an unvarying tone, neither shout nor cry, but nearly allied to both, pitched in the neighbourhood of Lower A, with his eyes fixed bravely on a knot in the deckhead above Mr. Stanhope. The envoy smiled bravely, and in the thundering chorus of To Make 'em Strike or Die, his neighbours made out his piping treble. The frigate could boast no high standard of musical accomplishment. Etheridge had never really known the tune of his comic song, and now, bemused by Mr. Stanhope's port, he forgot the words too. But when at last he abandoned it after three heavy falls, he assured them that, well sung by Kitty Pake, for example, it was irresistibly droll. How they'd laughed! But he was no hand at a song, he was sorry to say, though he loved music passionately. It was far more in the doctor's line. The doctor could imitate cats on the cello to perfection, would deceive any dog you cared to bring forward. Mr. Stanhope turned his worn, polite face towards Stephen, blinking in a shaft of sunlight that darted through a scuttle on the roll, and Stephen noticed for the first time that the faded blue eyes were showing the first signs of that whitish ring, the Arcus Senilis. But from the far end of the table, Mr. Atkins called out, "No, no, Your Excellency, we mustn't trouble Dr. Maturin. His mind is far above these simple joys." Stephen emptied his glass, set his eyes upon the appropriate knot, tapped the table, and began, "The seas their wonders might reveal, but Chloe's eyes have more, nor all the treasure they conceal can equal mine on shore." His harsh, creaking voice, indicating rather than striking the note, did nothing to improve the ship's reputation, but now Jack was accompanying him with a deep, booming hum that made the glasses vibrate, and he went on with at least greater volume, "From native Ireland's temperate coast remove me farther, yet to shiver in eternal frost or melt with India's heat." It was at this point that he saw Mr. Stanhope would not be able to outlast another verse. The heat, the want of air, the surprise had the breeze directly aft and almost none came below, the tight-packed cabin, the necessary toasts, the noise, had done their work, and the rapidly whitening face, the miserable fixed smile, meant a syncope within the next few bars. "Come, sir," he said, slipping from his place. "Come, a moment, if you please." He led him to his sleeping cabin, laid him down, loosened his neckcloth and waistband, and when some faint colour began to return, he left him in peace. Meanwhile, the party had broken up, had tiptoed away. And, unwilling to answer inquiries on the quarter-deck, Stephen made his way forward through the berth-deck and the sick-bay to the head of the ship, where he remained throughout the frigate's evening activities, leaning on the bowsprit and watching the cutwater sheer through mile after mile of ocean, parting it with a sound like tearing silk, so that it streamed away in even curves along the Surprise's side to join her wake, now 8,000 miles in length. The unfinished song ran in his head, and again he sang beneath his breath, "Her image shall my days beguile, and still my dream shall be...
Dream. That was the point. Little contact with reality, perhaps. A child of hope. A potentiality. Infinitely better left unrealized. He had been most passionately attached to Diana Villiers, and he had felt a great affection for her, too. A strong affection, as from one human being to another in something of the same case. And that, he thought, she had returned to some degree, all she was capable of returning. To what degree? She had treated him very badly, both as a friend and a lover. And he had welcomed what he called his liberation from her. A liberation that had not lasted, however. No great while after his last sight of her prostituting herself in a box at the opera, a warm expression by which he meant consciously using her charms to please other men, the unreasoning part of his mind evoked living images of these same charms, of that incredible grace of movement when it was truly spontaneous. And very soon his reasoning mind began to argue that this fault, too, was to be assimilated to the long catalogue of defects that he knew and accepted. Defects that he felt to be outweighed, if not cancelled, by her qualities of wit and desperate courage. She was never dull. She was never cowardly. But moral considerations were irrelevant to Diana. In her, physical grace and dash took the place of virtue. The whole context was so different that an unchastity odious in another woman had what he could only call a purity in her. Another purity, pagan, obviously. A purity from another code altogether. That grace had been somewhat blown upon, to be sure, but there was enough and to spare. She had destroyed only the periphery. It was beyond her power to touch the essence of the thing. And that essence set her apart from any woman, any person he had ever known. This, at least, was his tentative conclusion, and he travelled these 8,000 miles with a continually mounting desire to see her again, and with an increasing dread of the event. Desire exceeding dread, of course. But, Lord, the infinite possibilities of self-deception... The difficulty of disentangling the countless strands of emotion and calling each by its proper name, of separating business from pleasure. At times, whatever he might say, he was surely lost in a cloud of unknowing. But at least it was a peaceful cloud at present, and sailing through a milky sea... towards a possible, though unlikely, ecstasy at an indefinite remove was, if not the fullness of life, then something like its shadow. Peace. Still deeper peace. The languid peace of the Arabian Sea in the southwest monsoon. A wind as steady as the trades, but gentler. So gentle that the battered surprise had her t'gallants abroad, and even her lower stansails, for she was in an even greater hurry than usual. Her stores were so low now that for weeks past the gunroom had been living on ship's provisions, salt beef, salt pork, biscuit, and dried peas. And the midshipman's berth reported no single rat left alive. What was worse, Stephen and Alistair had cases of scurvy on their hands once more. But the lean years were thought to be almost over. At one time Harrowby had wished to steer for the 9-degree channel and the Lacedaemonians, but Harrowby was an indifferent, timid navigator, and Jack, overruling him, had laid her head for Bombay itself. And now they had been running northeast by east so long that, by dead reckoning, the Surprise should have been 100 miles east of the Western Ghauts, another ark stranded in the hills of Pune. But consulting with Pullings, working his lunars again and again, dragging his brighter midshipmen repeatedly through the calculations in search of an error, worshipping his chronometers, and making the necessary corrections, Jack was almost certain of his position. Seabirds, native craft far off, a single merchantman that fled, crowding sail on the horizon, without waiting to learn if they were French or English, the first sail they'd seen in 4 months, and above all soundings in 11 fathoms, a bottom of shelly white sand like Direction Bank, strengthened him in his persuasion that he was in 18 degrees 34 minutes north, 72 degrees 29 minutes east, and that he should make his landfall the next day. He stood on the quarter-deck, glancing now over the side, now up at the masthead, where the sharpest eyes and the best glasses in the ship were trained steadily eastwards. Stephen's confidence in Captain Aubrey's seamanship was as entire, as blind, as Jack's in the medical omniscience of Dr. Maturin. And untroubled by the cares that now oppressed his friend, he sat in the main chains, as naked as Adam in much the same colour, trailing a purse-net in the sea. The chains, broad planks jutting horizontally from the outside of the ship to spread the shrouds wider than her extreme breadth, provided the most comfortable seat imaginable. He had all the advantage of the sun, of solitude, for the chains were well below the rail, and of the sea which ran curving past under his feet, sometimes touching them with a warm caress, sometimes sending an agreeable shower of spray over his person. And as he sat, he sang, Asperges me, Domine, hisopo. But those qualities were, of course, most apparent when she was poor, lonely, and oppressed. What shall I find now? What development, if indeed I call? Hisopo et super nivem deal babor. Asperges me. A passing sea-snake broke his song, one of the many he'd seen and failed to catch. He veered out his line, willing the creature to enter the purse. But an empty purse had no charm for the serpent. It swam on with scarcely a hesitation in its beautiful, proud, easy glide. Above and behind him he could hear Mr. Harvey's usually conciliating voice raised in passion, wanting to know whether those sweepers were ever coming aft, whether this bloody shambles was ever going to look like the deck of a man of war. Another voice, low, inward and confidential, was that of Babington, who had borrowed Stephen's Hindustani phrase-book. Over and over again he was repeating, "Woman, wilt thou lie with me?" in that language, staring impatiently northeastwards. Like many sailors, he could sense the loom of the land, a land with thousands of women upon it, every one of whom might perhaps lie with him. "No great guns this evening, Doctor," said Pullings, leaning over the rail. "We're prettying for tomorrow. I reckon we shall raise Malabar Hill before it's dark and the Admiral lays there in Bombay. We must be shipshape for the Admiral." Bombay. Fresh fruit for his invalids, iced sherbets for all hands, enormous meals, the marvels of the East, marble palaces, no doubt, the Parsis, silent towers, the offices of the commissioners for the former French settlements, counters and factories on the Malabar coast, the residence of Mr. Commissioner Canning. "How happy you make me, Mr. Pullings," said Stephen. "This will be the first evening since 30 South that we shall be spared that inhuman—" "Shh! Shh! Don't stir. I have it! Ha-ha, my friend, at last!" He hauled in his line, and there in the net lay a sea-snake, a slender animal shining black and brilliant yellow, quite amazing. "Don't touch her, Doctor!" cried Pullings. "She's a sea-serpent!" "Of course she's a sea-serpent! That has been the whole purpose of my fishing ever since we reached these waters. Oh, what a lovely creature!" "Don't touch her!" cried Pullings again. "She's deadly poison! I've seen a man die in 20 minutes!"
"Land ho!" hailed the lookout. "Land broad on the starboard beam!"
"Jump up to the masthead, Mr. Pullings, if you please," said Jack, "and let me know what you see." A thunder of feet, as the whole ship's company rushed to stare at the horizon, and the surprise took on a list to starboard. Stephen held his close-meshed net at a prudent distance. The serpent writhed furiously, coiled and struck like a powerful spring released.
"On deck there!" roared Pullings. "It's Malabar Hill itself, sir! And I see the island plain!"
The serpent, blind out of its own element, bit itself repeatedly. And presently it died. Before Stephen could bring it inboard to its waiting jar of spirit, its colours were already fading. But as he climbed in over the rail, so a waft of air took the frigate's sails aback, a breath of heavy air off the land, with a thousand unknown scents, the green smell of damp vegetation, palms, close-packed humanity. Another world.
Chapter 7 Fresh fruit for the invalids, to be sure, and enormous meals for those who had time to eat them. But apart from the omnipresent smell and a little arak that came aboard by stealth, the wonders of the East, the marble palaces, remained distant, half-guessed objects for the surprise. She was taken straight into the naval yard, and there they stripped her to the bone. They took out her guns and cleared her holds to come to her bottom. And what they found there made the master attendant clear the dry dock as fast as ever he could to bring her in before she sank at her moorings. The admiral visited her in state. He was a jolly, rose-pink admiral, and he said the kindest things about the surprise, but he instantly deprived Jack of his first lieutenant, appointing Mr. Harvey to an 18-gun sloop as master and commander, thereby throwing all the labour of refitting onto the captain's shoulders. The admiral had a conscience, however, and he knew that Mr. Stanhope was of some importance. He spoke the good word to the master attendant, and all the resources of a well-equipped yard lay open to the surprise. The daughter of the horse-leech was moderation made flesh compared to Captain Aubrey let loose in a Tom Tiddler's grounds strewn with pitch, hemp, tow, cordage, sailcloth by the acre, copper in gleaming sheets, spars, blocks, boats, and natural-grown knees. And although he, too, was afire to wander on the coral strand beneath the coconut palms, he said, "While this lasts, not a man shall leave the ship. Gather ye rose pods while ye may, as dear Christy Pellier used to say." May you not find the men grow willful and discontented? May they not for the